Welcome to the Foreign Policy Panel. I'm Stan Riveless, and I'm going to introduce our panel to you. We have really a remarkable panel on foreign policy of distinguished foreign policy experts, and it's really remarkable that we can bring five really distinguished people like this together on this stage just from our class alone. I think it really is tremendous evidence of the accomplishment of our class and of our classmates. The idea is to keep the formal presentations relatively brief. I'm going to ask Jerry Bremer to set the stage for us. What we're going to do is look ahead in this panel. We're going to look ahead to examine U.S. national security strategy over the next decade. President Obama delivered a speech in which he, in effect, said the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq are winding down, and so is the global war on terrorism. And in a sense, that poses the question for us to the extent to which that war is winding down and what conflicts and challenges are going to take its place. So as we look ahead, I would like to ask Jerry to set the stage and give us his formulation of the challenges that lie ahead. Jay Rixey, who spent many years in the intelligence community on my far right, I've asked him to address the intelligence perspective. Mike Skoll, who's a specialist on South America, to give us his assessment of this under-examined region of the world. Warren Hoag, who's moved from the New York Times to the NGO community to look at international diplomacy and with an emphasis on the Middle East. I will say a few words on the abiding nuclear problem, and then Wick Murray, Professor Murray, from the Naval Postgraduate School on my left, I've asked him to give us a broader historical perspective. And we're going to keep our formal presentations pretty short, and then we hope that we'll have a nice, lively discussion. So hold your questions till after the panel has said a few words, and then we'll open it up. Jerry, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Stan. It's great to be here. I've been admonished to be brief, and I'm reminded of the story of the sixth-grade boy who gave a report on Julius Caesar. In total, his report read, "Julius Caesar was a great general. He won many battles. He gave a long speech. They killed him." So I'll be brief. I want to leave you with three points. Actually, I'm going to take kind of a 50,000-foot look at the challenge for America in the coming century. And the three points are, number one, the international order basically follows the value system of the great power of the time. Secondly, we should not take for granted the current liberal international order we live under. And thirdly, there is no attractive alternative to America continuing to play the role of the global power. So let me address those in order. First of all, we sit here now about 150 years into what is actually an exception, which is a long period, broadly, of international order based on liberal values. It dates really from the British repeal of the Corn Laws 150 years ago, followed by outlawing slavery. And during the 19th century, this liberal order based on democracy, human rights, free trade, free markets, and freedom of the seas was policed by the British, particularly in the form of the Royal Navy. But as Robert Kagan points out in his brilliant book, The World America Made, it was not always that way. Previous hegemonic powers, whether global or regional, have not subscribed to these liberal values. Think of Philip II, Spain, the Ottoman Empire, France in the 17th and 18th century, and I would argue in the 21st century, Germany and Russia, at various times in the 19th and 20th centuries. These were not liberal hegemons, regional or global. And so the world did not move under a value system conducive to American interests. Now, at the end of the Second World War, America effectively inherited from the British this role. And I would argue that for our lifetimes, for the last 70 years, America has been an enormous force for good in the world. Two data points. Number one, the number of countries defined as free is twice the number they were at the end of the Second World War. And secondly, we have seen the greatest surge of economic prosperity in world history in the last 70 years. These are things that America helped make happen. Now, it isn't inevitable that the world will stay with those values, as I mentioned. There are plenty of times in the past when other countries have been either regional or global hegemons and have not worked to forward our values. And that's something we need to be concerned about. Why should we be concerned about it? Well, because the reigning political philosophy in Washington these days, and indeed in the nation, certainly encouraged by the current administration, but also joined by many people in the Republican Party, is to assume that the wars are over, it's time to come home, let's do our rebuilding at home. These are understandable concerns at the end of a decade of war. They're understandable, but are they wise? And I would argue they're not wise. Because the alternatives are what? There are essentially three alternatives to America continuing to play its role. First alternative is you get a new hegemon to take our place. Well, there are effectively three candidates. Russia, which moves every day closer to historic Russian autocracy, certainly not a model that would be conducive to American interests. There's China, which, though it will soon have the second largest economy in the world, is clearly not a free trader. And indeed, to the extent China builds its blue water navy, it builds it precisely for the opposite of freedom of the seas. It builds the navy to keep other forces out of the area, the water areas to the east of China in Japan and Taiwan, and now in the South China Sea. So China does not make a very appealing alternative hegemon. Well, you say, what about Europe? Europe at least shares our liberal values. But Europe is hamstrung by two things. First of all, they are obviously transfixed by their current economic problem. And it's not just the euro. It's a question about what a united Europe's role in the global economy will be, with Germany saying we should be engaged and France increasingly saying we should not be engaged. And the second problem, as recent events have shown, is Europe has so drastically cut its defense spending that it can no longer even police its own neighborhood, as we saw in Libya and more recently in Mali. So there's no attractive alternative great power to the United States. Well, then you say, well, what about a multipolar world? Some scholars talk about we could have a multipolar world. There are two problems with this. First of all, moving from one hegemonic power to another great power for millennia has been an almost surefire formula for war. Think of Cyrus in Persia, the Seljuk Turks in the 15th century, the Mongols in the 14th century, Spain, we've already talked about, and so forth. And those of you who, like me, enjoyed the lectures course of Hajo Holborn will recall his tremendous book, The Political Collapse of Europe, dealing with the rise of Wilhelmian Germany about a century ago. So the idea of moving to another hegemonic power itself is dangerous, and figuring out whether it should be a multipolar world is even more unsettling, because multipolar worlds, again, as Robert Kagan has decisively proven, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries were extremely unstable and very unpeaceful. So a multipolar world is not very attractive. So then there's a third option. You could say, well, what about international organizations? Could some international organization, some group, rise above sovereign states and figure out how to put in place an international order? I'm afraid history doesn't offer very much optimism about that option either. whether it's the League of Nations or the United Nations. So, my friends, we're left where we started. We're left with the United States again being in this century, in Madeleine Albright's lapidary phrase, the indispensable nation. And we should recall that it is a very clear lesson of history that when the great powers' power declines, if America's power were to decline, attachment to the liberal values we take very seriously would also decline, and that would be neither in our interests nor would it serve the values that we stand for. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Jay?
For those of you that benefited from the Gaddis's lecture this morning, Mike, is it working?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Well, bring it closer.
Those of you that heard Gaddis's talk this morning, I'm going to be the fox among the hedgehogs. The role of intelligence is to support policy-making decisions. Intelligence community doesn't get involved with policymaking decisions. If they do, they're wrong. They are there to get the information and provide it to the policymakers. And so that's what we do. So I want to let you know that first, what is intelligence? And then what we see right now might be the challenges going ahead is what we were asked to do over the next 10, 20 years. And even 10 years is, quite honestly, too short a time. But unfortunately, policymakers deal with what's happening right now. They very rarely have the time to lay out what's going to happen in the future. As Jerry knows, having been to the State Department, Mike and Stan, almost every incoming administration puts out their equivalent of PRIM 10 or some other new document to lay out their national security strategy, and then you spend the next four years trying to implement it. But something always comes up to interrupt it. Intelligence in the intelligence community, and there are 16 agencies in the intelligence community, only one of which is non-departmental. That's the CIA. The others all have a relationship with one of the departments in the executive branch. And when I first joined, you understand that people ask me, are you a spy? Well, if I were a spy, I'd say I work for agriculture or state, which they would object to. As an overt employee, you have to say you work for CIA. But what CIA does, what they do, and what the intelligence committee often does, is it steals. So you're immediately in a conflict because you're out there to get stuff that doesn't belong to you so that you can analyze it and provide it to policymakers to help them make decisions. So you got to understand there's a little dichotomy going on that you're doing something that in this country would be illegal. So you're not supposed to do that, but you're basically out there to get secrets. One of the things that policymakers always want to know is they want to know whatever the crisis du jour is, what are my adversary's capabilities and what are their intentions? Capabilities are sometimes hard to find out, but they're a hell of a lot easier to find out than intentions. And by capabilities, during the whole Cold War period, we used to use satellites and these other things to get into denied areas, and now we have other things, because what is happening over the last 15 years and is going to continue to accelerate is the realization that we live in a digital domain. How many out there have a smartphone? Okay. Now, all of you right now are subject to being hacked. Okay. If you're not aware of it, if you have refrigerators now come with IP addresses. As a matter of fact, we found that in the intelligence community, they have these things called SCIFs, which are compartmented areas and whatnot where you can deal the highest classified information. There was a time not too long ago where somebody had a refrigerator in a SCIF, and all of a sudden they realized it had an IP address which somebody on the outside could get in and listen to what was going on. Just in the paper today, there was somebody who is the head of the National Intelligence Council. His whole computer system, he was hacked, and somebody got in, took screenshots of his computer, and compromised his stuff. So the intelligence community is out there to try to get this information by technical means and whatnot. Some of the challenges we face in the intelligence community going forward to give the policymakers the best that we can are that we are in a cyber domain, increasingly so, and we don't understand what all that means. Europe has now, both the EU and NATO, in their official documents, and it takes the EU about three times as long as it does NATO to get to that point, which is even slower than we do, but they've recognized that the conventional threat is really dramatically reduced. The unconventional threat to them is growing. They're seeing a blur between internal security and external security. And how do they deal with that? The head of, there was Covello, who's the head of the fellow that had the, they were hacked, but they had the badges that you could use to get on secure systems in all these companies. He said it used to be that nation states did nation state stuff and criminals did criminal stuff. And now you have nation states using criminal organizations to do nation state stuff and trying to sort it out. You just don't know who is doing what. Over the next 10 years and even beyond, we're going to see an increasing number of failed states, which is going to lead to breeding grounds for terrorism and whatnot. We're going to see the problem that the obverse of it is economic security is a precursor to national security. So when you have countries, for example, in North Africa, where you have 80% of the population is under 30 males, and 90% of them are unemployed, what are they going to do? They're going to go to drug running and arms trafficking and, you know, jihadism or whatever you want to do it. So if those countries can get good economic development, you'll put the people to work and they won't be doing anything else. We see the same thing in our country here. As again, I say the cyber and coming to terms with it, the fact that we live in a digital domain, we really have to understand what that means and what we need to do and how we need to use it. Again, Europe, we're going to see a merger between law enforcement activities and intelligence activities, which in this country is a no-no. The intelligence community cannot do law enforcement things, and there's a fine line in this country. But in the rest of the world, they're trying to figure out how to deal with this. Because Europe has realized that its biggest threats to its internal security, many of which are fomented externally, they're finding bad guys outside of Europe who are using the internet to influence domestic people to do bad things. They're finding the immigration problem is tremendous. They actually had Frontex, which is an organization in Europe to monitor immigration. So you had a Latvian plane flying in the Aegean Sea watching a Turkish Coast Guard vessel escorting a bunch of illegal immigrants to get into Greece so that they get into Europe, and then they automatically become European citizens and go anywhere. So they're trying to figure out how to deal with all this. The real question is the role of intelligence, and the role of intelligence, again, is to provide the best information we can by whatever means we can get it to the policymakers so that the hedgehogs know what they want to pursue in the going forward. I'll leave it at that. We'll take questions. Stan?
Thank you, Jay. Mike?
Well, let me turn to Latin America, my little part of the world, a part of the world which, from Washington's point of view, bears between little interest and no interest. Now, there rarely are crises. I think, as a Latin Americanist, I think it's a hell of a lot more important than that, but nobody else seems to think that. It is Latin America a larger trading partner than Europe or China is. It's where we live. It's where most of the illegal or illegal immigrants come. It's an important area for us. And I want to follow up on what Jerry suggested about the need for American leadership. I feel very strongly that America must continue to lead. There's no alternative. That's just as true with variations in Latin America. When I entered the Foreign Service, there were two countries that were democratic in all of Latin America, depending on how you counted, maybe three. Mexico, maybe. Costa Rica, definitely. Colombia, definitely. When I left the Foreign Service 30 years later, there was only one country that was unequivocally non-democratic. That was Cuba. Now, how did that happen? Was this an indigenous movement in Latin America that moved from non-democracy to democracy and, by the way, at the same time, moved toward state-controlled industries to an area which is mostly, not all, but mostly, and the vast majority of the people under a free market, open investment systems? How did this happen? Well, I would argue, if you look deeply into it, despite the lack of interest by Washington as a whole, without the United States, under various presidents, Democratic and Republican, starting maybe with Jimmy Carter, moving into Ronald Reagan, up until about the present time, the notion of supporting democracy and free trade, open markets, capitalism, in Latin America was a basic tenet of U.S. policy. It was a lucky kind of policy in that it didn't cost much money. It was leadership. It was, some people call, soft power. I hate that term because power is not soft. But it was the United States that led through persuasion, through a rather intelligent mix of free trade agreements, most of them one way to begin, and the power of American business to show that the country that allowed investment boomed, while the country that didn't allow investment didn't boom. I mean, right now, take a couple of maps and draw red and blue on the booming countries and draw red and blue on the less democratic countries, and you're going to find the more statist countries, you're going to find a remarkable, almost absolute coincidence between failing states on the one hand that are statist and edging toward non-democracy, and the other type. And I would claim that the United States has been largely the leader, the only leader. No other country in the hemisphere, even the most democratic countries in the hemisphere, has the kind of power, the kind of penetration of these countries, and the volition, the mission, if you will. Costa Rica is very democratic. It's been democratic for 150 years, but Costa Rica does not send out the Peace Corps and do kinds of things to influence Brazil to be a nice, democratic, open-market country. Now, frankly, there are challenges to that right now. We've fallen away, quite frankly. In the last few years, there has been a lessening of the willingness of the United States to be the leader in Latin America, and we've seen it as the promise of the Summit of the Americas in 1994, which was pledged everybody to democracy and to free trade. Now, the last summit was a battle between Colombia on the one hand and Venezuela on the other, and the U.S. really didn't feel didn't have the oats to get involved in the argument, and we're suffering. Venezuela is my favorite example because I spent a few years there. There are 50,000 Cuban troops in Venezuela. The government of Venezuela launders between $50 and $100 million a day in money from the narcotics traffickers, from Iran. There's three flights a day from Tehran to Caracas. Venezuelan oil money is not spent to help the poor in Venezuela. It's helped to prop up Cuba, $4.5 billion a year, and a number of other countries. Chavez and his successors and the leaders of Bolivia and Ecuador are trying, with some success, to challenge U.S. hegemony, if you want, or at least influential power in the hemisphere, and they're having some influence. Let me stop with citing two examples of how U.S. power has successfully been exercised recently in the hemisphere. One is Plan Colombia, several billion dollars over the years, three Bushes and a Clinton very actively supporting this policy to help the Colombian army build up to a level where it's one of the finest fighting forces in the world and which has all but eliminated the guerrillas in Colombia. The second part, and this is something we're doing very well, the second part of this is that we are actually now beginning to finance the Colombian army doing the same thing in Central America and Mexico. It's working. We're doing it very quietly. But it is one example of what we're doing right today, American leadership. Colombia would not do it alone. But as long as they have American backing, not a lot of money, no, there are no American troops anywhere in any of these places. I just have the feeling that we in our hemisphere and all those people there, the hundreds of millions, we would be in deep trouble. We would go more deeply into trouble if we fail to revive the kind of leadership we have exercised in Latin America for at least the last 40 years.
Thank you very much, Mike. Warren? I want to make sure you can hear me. Earlier today, I was at another meeting, and I shouted at my friend Gurney Williams something, and he said, "I can't hear you." And I said, "Why can't you hear me? I have my hearing aids in." I'm going to try to answer the question that's on the in the rubric of what are our national interests and where are the resources to pursue them within the context of diplomacy, and start with, I think, what we must avoid doing as Americans abroad, and that is overreaching. I think the world right now, Jerry referred to this as a world where globalization and revolutionary technologies and the rise and decline of new and old powers have produced a world, some people call it bipolar, meaning China and the U.S. Some people call it, as Jerry said, nonpolar. And I like to think of it as a world where America still has primacy but does not dominate the way it once did. As to it, whether it's indispensable or dispensable, that's something to debate back and forth. But I like the phrase, we still have primacy, which means we still must be the leader, but we are not the dominant leader the way we were before, the only one. I don't believe America is in decline, but I do believe that its reputation for fairness and its reputation for competence has suffered over the past decade or so. The bipolar world, if you buy into that, obviously the other side of that is China. I like to think of China as our chief rival, and that's the word I choose. It is a rival, not an enemy, and I think that's how we must keep it. There is a meeting next week between Xi Jinping, the new president of China, who has given off some signals right now of being different from his predecessors, just as recently as last week, sort of stiff-armed North Korea in a meeting in Beijing, and has already changed the relationship between China and North Korea. China now wants the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's a change. That's a change, in our direction. This meeting next week in California between Obama and Xi, the two things they really must take up, I think. One of the most important things is the two militaries must develop some kind of communication, some kind of understanding, because the real worry, I don't think, and I don't think this based on what I've heard from people that I regularly listen to at meetings at places like the Asia Society, the National, and the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, sometimes off the record, sometimes on. I get no evidence that either side, the U.S. or China, wants confrontation. They recognize there are differences, but I think the real desire is to avoid confrontation. The only danger of confrontation I can see is a reckless act, and that would be a military act. And where I worry about that is China-Japan, China-Taiwan, and I think that must be avoided. And one way to avoid that, this meeting next week, is to establish some kind of communication between the two militaries. Secondarily, the real threat, and it's been recognized publicly by Washington, I'm glad to see that they've done that, is the cyber war threat. I mean, we just know now conclusively that China is behind so much of what's going on, and I'm sure that will be a subject that will come up in California, and it must be an ongoing subject of communication between the U.S. and China, because therein lies really, really dangerous possibilities. I think in the future, when America projects its power, it has to be done in sort of situational alliances, recognizing that our old allies don't have the same capacity they once did. Jerry mentioned that in the case of Europe, and we've just seen it last week, where the Germans want to do one thing in Syria and the French and the British want to do something else. They have no foreign policy in the European Union, and that's a problem. So I think we've got to think in the future of alliances with countries like Brazil, with countries like India, with countries like Turkey. And these are situational in the different parts of the world that I just mentioned in mentioning those three countries. Now, one of the ironies is, in this globalized world, where there is so much communication and so much understanding, you have a rise now of nationalism and a rise of tribalism and a rise of sectarian warfare. Seen from the United Nations, and I work in an institute that's just across the street from the UN, has no relationship to it, but obviously that's the dialogue that I'm listening to all the time. The real problem in the world these days is not wars between states. They hardly exist anymore. But it's wars within states, and that means sectarian conflict. It also makes intervention much more difficult by us
because, and take the case of Syria, where it is awfully hard to identify who we ought to be allied with, and that's where the debate lands right now. And yet at the same time, whereas the public, I don't think will ever, or at least anytime soon, support real mass troop deployments. I don't think they will support wars anymore of the kinds we fought in the last 10 or 15 years. The public is demanding humanitarian intervention. The public, properly upset and motivated by what's happening in countries like Syria, want the U.S. to do something. So that's a mandate from the public, and it's a very difficult mandate to fulfill. I would say that I think we need to promote American values, but do it in a more collective way than maybe we've done it in the past. And certainly in problems like terrorism that know no national borders, that becomes a pretty obvious imperative. The economic slowdown and the crisis and the appearance of dysfunction in Washington really hurts us abroad. And I can just give you one quick example of that, not an example, but somebody else who's thought about this. Richard Haass, who was a member of both Bush administrations and also the Clinton administration, so he's seen things from the inside, has written a new book called American Foreign Policy Begins at Home. I've read the book. It's a very good book. But just that title tells you that he is recognizing that we have to get our own house in order before we can go off and represent the values and lecture other people. A couple of things. Democracy promotion is a good thing, but I think we have to do it in a more intelligent manner. Forcing it onto people simply does not work. I think we have to talk to bad guys. I think we have to talk to Iran. I think we have to talk to Hamas. I think we have to talk to the Taliban. I think particularly in Syria, and we are, we have to talk to the Russians. Because in all these situations, in order to reach some kind of resolution, particularly in these confrontational, antagonistic ones, you have to, as a matter of course, understand the national interest and the purposes and the red line concerns of the country, of your adversary, who you're dealing with. And that means you have to talk to them. The pivot to China, I think, is correct, but there's a notion, I think, that we can kind of leave the Middle East alone now. Jerry mentioned the fact that there is this idea that the war is over, and I know that was more about terrorism in the Middle East, but we are pulling out of it. We have pulled out of Iraq. We're pulling out of Afghanistan. The Middle East is not going to cooperate. They're not going to leave us alone. They're not going to suddenly stop wanting United States intervention. And so the pivot to China, which is the right idea, I think, must not be done at the expense of maintaining interest in the Middle East. And Stan mentioned I would focus there. Let me just do 2 minutes on the Middle East. In Iran right now, there are elections upcoming. Unfortunately, the most hardline candidate, who is the nuclear negotiator, whose name is Jalili, and I have met him and seen him and seen him in action. I also see Iranian diplomats all the time in the UN community. And they drive a very tough bargain. But I do think that we have to progress to a point of offering them something so that they can back off of some of the positions they have taken in order to arrive at some sort of negotiation. Iranians are very good at playing for time, but I would counsel that we have to be patient. Sanctions, which we have in face right now, I think are the right thing, but sanctions are a very blunt instrument, and they risk making the Iranian regime even more repressive and even more hard-headed about resisting any idea that they are giving in to sanctions or buckling under sanctions. And I have been to Tehran, and I think that's sort of a national attitude. It's a nationalistic attitude. They don't want to give in to something that looks like pressure. And so our purpose becomes apply the pressure, but do it in some sort of way that doesn't put them in a position which is untenable for them. I think right now, looking at Iran, the way I want to look at Iran, I don't want to make Israel's red lines our red lines. I want to look at Iran as how it threatens U.S. national security, and I don't believe it does right now. The one thing they were capable of doing, or we were afraid they could do, was choking off the Straits of Hormuz, which would affect global oil traffic. I know from talking to people rather high up in the government, the U.S. now believes they no longer have they cannot do that. If Iran cannot do that, then Iran knows it cannot do that. To my mind, that removes any immediate threat to U.S. national interest, and it argues for sticking with it, for being patient, for playing the thing out. Let me go from Iran to the Middle East, and I'll end there. I think right now an Israeli attack on Iran is less likely than it would have been about a year ago. The Israeli security sector is against it. They have told Netanyahu they are against it. That is a problem for Netanyahu. He cannot really act when his own national security people are saying rather publicly they think it's a dumb idea. I don't know if any of you saw a film called The Gatekeepers, but it was an extraordinary film where all the past leaders of Shin Bet came out and said virtually that. I think Israel also, though, has got another problem. Israel now has built up extraordinary security. It is a very successful entrepreneurial nation. It was not before. And I go to Israel quite often, and it's produced a sort of complacency, I think. When they were feeling threatened, they were certainly not complacent. Now they have secured themselves. They've secured themselves in ways that I think make them exceedingly unpopular and may produce a counter-reaction, which I'll talk about in a second. But let me just finish on the point. My institute where I work, International Peace Institute, the president is a man called Terje Rode-Larsen. He's a Norwegian diplomat, and he was one of the two or three people responsible for what is known as the Oslo peace process. That peace process is faltering, struggling, but still it's the basis on which Middle East peace has been negotiated or stalled or whatever you want to say. At the center of that is the two-state solution. I still think, passionately, this remains the only way out of the dilemma. Why? It is more existential for Israel than I think it is for the Palestinians, because in about a decade, the way the demographics are going, Israel will have a Muslim majority population. When that happens, Israel is no longer the Jewish state, and it is no longer a democracy, because those people will not have equal rights. What position does that leave us in as Israel's primary defender if we're having to defend a country that basically is an occupying power? Let me tell you where I stand with Israel. I worked before the New York Times many, many years ago for the New York Post in New York. This was long before Rupert Murdoch bought it. The old New York Post at that point was a real bleeding heart liberal New York Post. It was a New York Post that championed Jews and Israel, and people used to quip that a headline for the New York Post of that period, and I was the city editor writing those headlines, that a proper headline would say, "Cold wave hits New York. Jews, Negroes suffer most." We wore our liberal hearts on our sleeves. So I am a forthright supporter of the State of Israel, always have been. And let me just finish on that point. There are some areas where the domestic American political argument really undercuts foreign affairs. And I think in no area more strongly than in the Middle East. In our national elections, you get phrases like so-and-so is throwing Israel under the bus. That was preposterous, it was foolish, it was reckless, and all Israeli national sector, security sector people said nothing of the kind, really quite the contrary. That kind of language is a real setback, and it's a function when an international situation becomes part of our very polarized national dialogue, and it's a real setback. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Warren. I don't know about the rest of you, but I have a lot of nostalgia for the Cold War. The bipolar world created a mechanism for keeping order that in some way we lack today, despite the primacy that the U.S. enjoys in the world. So I want to reinforce what Jerry Bremer said in his point one, which is that the international order conforms itself to the distribution of power in the world. And I want to bring that notion to bear on this nuclear problem. We've now had more than a half a century of experience with nuclear weapons. And traditionally, that nuclear weapon problem has been roughly segmented into what we call arms reduction and non-proliferation. Arms control and arms reduction is the effort to make sure we don't blow ourselves up with nuclear weapons and that we, in a balanced and verifiable manner, bring the levels of nuclear weapons down between the superpowers. And in this sense, Russia is still a superpower. Non-proliferation, that was for other people and other, you know, diplomats to worry about. But that has reversed itself now. And that's my first point, is that the decline of the bipolar world has created a fragmentation of power which has permitted and to a certain extent encouraged other states to seek their own security through nuclear weapons. If you don't have an ally to protect you, you have to help yourself. So self-help is the basis of all national security and is the reason why states seek nuclear weapons. The second point is that all of this started to occur in the mid to late 90s. Up until 1995, we had great success in pursuing both arms reductions with Soviet Union and Russia, and in reducing the number of states that possessed or were pursuing nuclear weapons. In the mid to late 90s, the Republic of South Africa gave up its nuclear weapons. Argentina had a nuclear weapons program that they gave up. The breakup of the Soviet Union left nuclear weapons high and dry. In the Ukraine, Belarus and Kazakhstan, and we were able to make arrangements for the repatriation of those nuclear weapons over a period of time. So we had a kind of a perfect virtuous circle. And sort of what took us by surprise, perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised, but that all of a sudden we saw states beginning to come above ground with their nuclear weapons program and begin to test those weapons. First it was India, then Pakistan, and then North Korea, and now, of course, we face the Iranian problem. And what we also find is, just as Mike Skoll and Jay were talking about in the area of criminal organizations, smaller groups are seeking nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction. You know, which is to me evidence of this fragmentation of power, this lack of an international structure and order to control the renegades, which is what international order is all about. And the third and final point I want to make is that, in my view, the momentum for both arms reductions and non-proliferation has really slowed over the last several years. Part of it is, you know, we can blame it on one administration or the other, but unfortunately there are some deep problems that stand in the way of both arms reductions and non-proliferation. We have a recalcitrant Russia, and that is clear. And they're making themselves very difficult, willfully making politics very difficult. So they're non-cooperative. At the same time, even if they were cooperative, we have reached a level of nuclear weapons where it was very difficult to negotiate reductions without the multilateral involvement. Because at some point we've reached levels where British nuclear weapons, French nuclear weapons, Chinese nuclear weapons become relevant to the discussion of all of how many nuclear weapons we can reduce. In a private discussion, Warren asked me about the future of the Obama commitment to zero out nuclear weapons. Well, it's very far in the future at this point. And you can't get to zero without involving other states. Other states, you know, are going to be very reluctant to get involved in that. The second point is on the non-proliferation front, and that's even a more severe problem. We can certainly, kind of float along at the current level of nuclear weapons, and as long as relations don't get out of hand, there's no danger of nuclear war. But on the non-proliferation problem, we've got the problem of rogue states, Iran and North Korea, that, for reasons of self-help, view nuclear weapons as essential or potentially essential to their own security. Now, how do we handle that? We come to a crossroads. We've tried sanctions, and they don't work very well. We can try to put pressure on them and deny them things, standing in the world and economic trade, etc., but that only increases their incentive to acquire nuclear weapons because they feel more and more threatened. So what is the alternative to sanctions? Well, there is regime change. Warren referred to the question of Israel and Iran. Or there's accommodation. And these are very difficult choices in and of themselves, regardless of the administration. And it may be that we really, if we're not prepared for regime change, which involves the use of force, and I don't think there's much appetite for that, then we have to seriously consider some way of managing the ambitions of these states, and somehow perhaps bringing them into the community as opposed to further isolating them. These are dilemmas that we face. So right now we are at a crossroads with respect to the nuclear weapons issue, both with respect to reductions and nonproliferation, and we've got some very hard choices to make. Thanks. Wick.
As an historian, I guess I have to say that while there are a number of trends that are extremely favorable in terms of the United States, and in fact, I think one could argue that if we get through the next 5 to 10 years in terms of managing in some fashion, which is somewhat doubtful, the huge problem of overspending by our federal government, that the return of substantial portions of industry to the United States, not the jobs, but the industries, given the technological advances that we have made, and the fact that it's entirely conceivable that in 10 to 15 years, North America will be energy independent, which has considerable implication. Despite that, I am profoundly pessimistic. And the reason for that simply comes from the fact that in our efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan, we have profoundly, if you will, managed to remake the mistakes that were made in the past. In terms of Iraq, we not only managed to repeat every single major mistake that was made in the Vietnam War, but in addition to that, we managed to make every single mistake the British had made in 1920 in Mesopotamia in putting down the revolt that occurred in that year. In Afghanistan, we have managed to repeat all the mistakes the Brits made in the 1840s, early 1840s, and most of the mistakes the Soviet Union made in Afghanistan in the 1980s. The question is, are things going to change? And here I think there are some societal and cultural and intellectual aspects that stand in our way. The first, I would argue, is a largely dysfunctional national security bureaucracy. In other words, the incapacity of those thinking about foreign policy and strategy to come up with anything that's halfway intelligent. The days, and I'll tell you a story along those lines in a second, but the days of of NSC 68 or NSDD 75, in which outside individuals were pulled in or individuals spent most of their time outside of the government to write really quite perceptive and deeply thoughtful pieces of strategic analysis don't seem to occur much anymore. Washington, of course, is right now enormously enthralled with the idea of strategy. We have efforts, the national military strategy, the national strategy, the national strategy against terrorism. We can run through the national maritime strategy. And all of these documents, I think, were best summed up by a Navy Admiral friend of mine who was asked to comment on a draft of the national military strategy. And his comment back was that every place that where the United States appeared or U.S. or American appeared, that if you changed it to Iceland and Icelandic, it would be equally applicable to Iceland. In other words, the document at absolutely zero value. What it, of course, reflects, I think, is a bureaucracy more concerned with being a bureaucracy than dealing with substantive problems. An intelligence community in which the figures that came out last year that only 17% of the analysts in the Central Intelligence Agency read a foreign language or speak a foreign language. And again, these difficulties, I think, reflect a larger problem in the United States with the study of history or culture of foreign countries or languages, just simply the kind of, if you will, willingness to understand and capacity to understand the other, which marked education in the 1960s, and it wasn't all that great then, as the Vietnam War showed, is much worse now. And that gives us a general lack of understanding of the external world, so that while CNN has been wringing its hand, in fact, I came up with a wonderful what the acronym for CNN really stands for is the Cowardly Nanny Network. having wrung their hands over U.S. participation in Iraq and Afghanistan, are now very clearly enormously, and Warren touched on this, wringing their hands over what's happening in Syria. And if you thought Iraq was a mess in terms of culture and tribal difficulties and religious difficulties, wait till we get into Syria. And there's a wonderful book by Fuad Ayami on the nature of Syria, not a place we want to involve ourselves in. The long and short of this is that I have the feeling that what we may be coming back economically and in terms of our position in the world, our capacity, if you will, to decide what are essential national interests and what are, if you will, passing interests of the media of those who don't know much about the world, get pretty mixed up, so that we can end up perhaps, not perhaps, but in 25, 35 years repeating the mistakes we made in Iraq and maybe sooner. And I guess I'll sum up by telling my favorite Peter Cook and Dudley Moore story. I think most of you remember who Peter Cook and Dudley Moore were, but they did a skit called The Frog and the Peach. The skit involved a restaurant run by Peter Cook, located in the middle of the Yorkshire bogs. No problem in parking because the only problem is extracting the cars afterwards. Two specialties of the house, frog a la pêche, a large frog brought to your table with a peach in its mouth and boiling Cointreau poured over it, or the other specialty, pêche à la frog, a large peach brought to your table with boiling Cointreau poured over it, and when you cut it open, tadpoles swim out. So after 10 minutes of absolute insanity that those two guys were capable of, is your wife a well woman? No, we lower her down the well kicking and screaming to feed the frogs. At the end of all of this, Dudley Moore, who's the food critic for the London Times, says, have you learned from your mistakes? And Peter Cook says, yes, he says, I have studied it from every point of view, going over them again and again, and feel fully confident I can repeat to every one of them. The tragedy is, and comedy oftentimes melds into tragedy, is that I'm afraid we are capable of repeating every mistake we've made over the last 40 years.
Thank you very much. We're going to open it to questions in a moment, but I want to give the panelists an opportunity, if they wish, to say anything in reaction to these initial remarks. If not, let's please step up to the microphone and ask a question if you wish. Thank you.
Yeah, I think this panel, most of them except for Mr. Murray, have this kind of Manichaean attitude toward the world that I remember in the years past regarding the Soviet Union. Now, Mr. Skoll, he mentions the word Cuba. We're supposed to, like, shake in our boots, or Venezuela. They're really dangerous countries. They're really going to hurt us. And Israel's the good guy, and this one, and Iran is the bad guy. You know, that's that kind of thinking I don't think gets anyone anywhere. And it should be more subtle. I should think people who have been involved in diplomacy and everything would be a little more subtle. And they're actually using the word bad guys. And, you know, come on, let's try to see things a little more realistically. And as Mr. Bremer, after what he did in Iraq, freeing... putting, you say you're for liberalism, which means free economy, developed capitalism. So a little candy company in Basra now can't compete with imports from China, so they close up. People are without work. I just think there's a lot of things that you just assume are good, and other things that you assume are bad, and this is childish thinking, I think. Sorry.
Well, it's a fair point. It's a fair point that I assume the values that America has stood for 230 years are good ones. They include promotion of democracy, free trade, free markets, and at least for the last 70 years, policing the freedom of the seas. I think those are good things, objectively good. I think they serve American interests, and I think they reflect American values. So if you're critical of that, you and I have a disagreement.
I'd just like to add one more piece.
Paul, who do you? You're supposed to pick who goes.
Okay, Mike, you were.
Just the notion that we can't talk about bad guys. What kind of people blew up the Twin Towers in New York? Were these people who could be reasoned with? These were not bad guys. There have been bad guys in the history of our history throughout history. And we overwhelmingly have banded together against the bad guys. And frankly, I would fear for the world that would exist right now had we not done that.
Let me add to the two previous comments. Paul Bremer and I have considerable differences, obviously, but let me say that having been on the Iraqi Perspectives Project for 5 years studying the Iraqi documents which we captured, that if you want to call somebody a bad guy, I'm more than happy to call Saddam Hussein a truly bad guy who managed to kill somewhere around 750,000 of his own people and to use sarin gas against the people who were revolting in March of 1991 against his regime. The tragedy of the whole Iraq mess was that we did not try and prevent Saddam from gassing and mass murdering tens of thousands of his own people.
I'm just going to offer my own slightly different point of view, and that is that, you know, Working in an area like the reduction of nuclear weapons requires two things. It requires an optimism that you can actually prevent nuclear war, but a pessimistic understanding that countries seek their own defenses and will seek to protect their interests with whatever means possible. And I think at least the one kind of common denominator on the panel that without getting into the sort of the personalities of the actors as such, that power in the world, there is no judge and jury and no court of international justice that makes decisions among nation states. Nation states and other actors make their own decisions and try to impose those upon others. I think that is a common denominator that we do have to recognize when we approach the challenges of the world. We can then go on to talk about the intentions of the actors, and I personally agree that I believe our intentions are superior to many others. But there is an irreducible element of power and conflict in the world that we cannot get away from. And that element of power and conflict inevitably can bring lead to the potential for war. Jeff, you want to stand?
Yes, thank you. I just came from the China discussion, and I want to ask the same question that I did there to this panel. And I can encapsulate it maybe in one word: entanglement. I think we are proceeding on a slight upward curve of entanglement with China. Import-export, trade, Walmart, capital investment both ways, slowly moving along. Bank flows of funds are providing an element, increasing element of entanglement. Do you think, as a panel, that this will tend over time, maybe a short time, to reduce the likelihood of adventurism on their part? Will this diminish the idea of aggression by China?
Warren, do you want to take a crack at that?
Only that I actually, while you were at the other panel, I did talk about China for a moment. I simply said that this meeting...
I was here for that as well.
Okay, well, then I won't repeat. I was going to say the danger of adventurism, I think, is with the Chinese military. And that's why I think that what we must do right away is to make sure the two militaries, American and Chinese, are talking to each other and understand each other.
I agree with Warren about that last point particularly. I've been involved in what is called a second track discussion with the Chinese military for some years, and it is appalling that 50 years after we set up a hotline to manage things with Russia, we really don't have such a thing with China. There is a phone that rings in Zhongnanhai, and somebody picks up the phone and says, Dui, we have no idea who it is. We have no idea if Obama wanted to speak in a crisis to Xi that he could do it. But more importantly, our military based in the Pacific, in Honolulu, has no reliable channel of communications with the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, and that is really dangerous, I think. One point I disagree with Warren on is he said that he thinks the days of state-to-state warfare are over. We need to worry about wars within states. This is certainly not the case in Asia. China has managed to repeat what Wilhelmian Germany did, which was to feel itself encircled and then take actions to ensure that it indeed is encircled by people who don't like it. Vietnam, Thailand, Philippines. It has major territorial disagreements with every single one of its neighbors. We just read last week about their dispute with India. So state-to-state relations are still going to be very important in Asia, and I think Warren agrees that there is a danger of a real state-to-state war there, something we need to pay attention to, particularly the Chinese-Japanese angle.
Yeah, I would first like to praise this distinguished gentleman on the left here who said that we have a very sort of arbitrary way of labeling people. I'm curious as to why, for example, Iraq, or rather Iran, is a rogue state, but Pakistan is not. Pakistan is unstable. Pakistan has the atomic bomb. Pakistan harbors enemies of the United States, but we're very friendly and supportive of Pakistan. Iraq is an enemy. I'm also curious as to why we label some people anti-democratic and others, for example, Saudi Arabia, because of our oil interest, we say we don't say anything. Well, that's all I have to say.
Could I speak to Pakistan? In some ways, I think Pakistan is the most dangerous country in the world. It is a country that took the greatest nuclear proliferator we have ever known, A.Q. Khan, and turned him into a national hero. They took the doctor who led us to Osama bin Laden and jailed him. They are a country, we give them enormous amounts of military aid. They are directly responsible for killing Americans in Afghanistan through their the ISI, which is their intelligence arm. They basically created the Taliban. They are a menace in that way, but at the same time, they are really important to us. And so we have to keep dealing with them. And the only positive thing about Pakistan has just happened. They had a national election. They had a peaceful transfer of power. They have a prime minister now who we have dealt with before. He is anti-American, but that does not mean that we should not stop dealing with him. Pakistan is dependent upon the kind of aid we give them, and if that aid ended, it would be a real problem for Pakistan. The Taliban that they created is now a problem for them internally. I guess my point would be about Pakistan would be, I don't call them a good guy or say that they, since they are bad, we shouldn't be supporting them, but we have to support them to a certain degree because they are so important to our national interest in that part of the world. So we have to find a way to deal with them. And there is a new prime minister right now. And if diplomatically we can impress upon him the importance of that relationship, then I think that's a positive act. It does mean we have a double standard. But I think to have a single standard is just not a proper way to conduct relations in the world. It is just not a moral place.
We have other questions over here, so I want to move ahead over here.
First of all, I'm really proud to be in the same class with you guys. It's a class act, and I appreciate the effort that you put into this. Beneath much of what has been talked about is a backdrop of technology. Jay touched on it. Certainly the nuclear situation has changed. When you look back to when we were kids, the submarines were powered by diesel engines. The nuclear weapons just came into power when I was about 3 or 4. Came into use for the first time when I was 4. And things have changed so much exponentially since then in ways that Jay touched on, Stan has touched on. And no one has mentioned drones, but there are now drone-like weapons in progress and even production that work in swarms, and they're all small, like birds. And all of this technology changes the nature of war potentially. And my question is, how does technology change from now on the nature of war? Will there be, for example, less bloodshed?
Wick is the expert on the nature of war. How is technology changing the way in which our forces are organized?
There are two fundamental aspects to this, and we got badly screwed up in the 1990s by an overemphasis on technology. There's a fundamental nature to war that hasn't changed since before the history. And that is, war is always a matter of horror and killing and fear, and one that is guided more so than any other human endeavor by chance and accident. It is a nonlinear phenomenon. And it will never change. The enemy always gets a vote. Technology doesn't change that fundamental nature the way some of the people in the 1990s in the American military thought, and as we have discovered in Iraq. What does change are the capabilities. with which you can employ those forces. And we have developed extraordinary capabilities which still have not been able to, if you will, suppress the kind of insurgent movements that we have run into in Iraq and Afghanistan. We were able to politically make a deal with the Sunnis that ended a substantial portion of their insurgency against us in the 2007-2008 period with the surge that took place. But what we have discovered is human beings are enormously flexible, adaptable to technological change, and no matter how superior our weapon systems may be, the enemy will still always get a vote.
Have one more question. Well, thank you very much. We've enjoyed speaking to you.